Chapter 9. Carlton opened his eyes, disoriented, his head stuffed tight with a massive, pulsing ache. He was half-sitting, stiffly propped against a wall, and he found he could not move his arms. His body was covered in little, random places of sharp pain and tingling numbness. He tried to shift away from the discomfort, but he was restrained somehow, and the little moves he could make just made new places hurt. He looked around the room, trying to get his bearings. It looked like a storage room. There were boxes along the walls, and discarded cans of paint and other cleaning supplies littered the floor, but there was more. There were piles of furry fabric everywhere. Carlton peered at them sleepily. He felt muzzy, like if he closed his eyes he could just fall back asleep so easily. No. He shook his head hard, trying to clear it, and yelped. Oh, no. He groaned as the throbbing in his head demanded attention, and his stomach flipped. He clenched his jaw and closed his eyes, waiting for the pounding and nausea to recede. Eventually they did, fading back to something almost manageable, and he opened his eyes again, starting over. This time his mind had cleared a little, and he looked down at his body to see his restraints. Oh, no. He was wedged inside the heavy, barrel-shaped torso of a mascot costume, the headless top half of some kind of animal. His arms were trapped inside the torso section, pinned to his sides in an unnatural position by some sort of framework. The arms of the costume hung limp and empty from the sides. His legs stuck out incongruously from the bottom, looking small and thin in contrast. He could feel other things inside the mascot's torso, pieces of metal that pressed against his back and poked into him. He could feel raw patches on his skin, and he could not tell if the thing he felt trickling down his back was sweat or blood. Something was pressing into the sides of his neck. When he turned his head, whatever it was dug into his skin. The costume's fur was dirty and matted, a faded color that might once have been a bright blue, but was now only a bluish approximation of beige. He could see a head of the same color a few feet away, sitting on a cardboard box, and with a flicker of curiosity he looked at it, but he could not tell what it was supposed to be. It looked as if someone had been told, "Make an animal," and had done just that, careful not to make it look like any specific type of animal. He looked around the room, comprehension dawning. He knew where he was. The piles of fabric had faces. They were empty costumes, mascots from the restaurant, deflated, collapsed, and staring empty-eyed at him, like they wanted something. He looked around, trying to assess calmly, though his heart was fluttering alarmingly in his chest. The room was small, a single bulb overhead lighting it dimly and flickering ever so slightly, giving the place a disquieting impression of movement. A small metal desk fan, brown with rust, gently oscillated in the corner, but the air it blew was heavy with the stale sweat of costumes left unwashed for a decade. Carlton was too hot. The air felt too thick. He tried to stand, but without his arms he could not brace himself, and as he moved he felt another violent wave of nausea and a sudden, angry surge of pain in his head. "I wouldn't do that," a raspy voice muttered. Carlton looked around, seeing no one. Then the door opened. It moved slowly, and somewhere beneath his terror, Carlton felt a twinge of impatience. "Who is it? Let me out of this," he said in panicked desperation. The door squealed like an injured animal as it glided open, almost of its own accord, the frame empty. After a moment's pause, a yellow rabbit poked its head around the corner, its ears tilting at a jaunty angle. It was still for a moment, almost posing. Then it came in with a bouncing walk, graceful, with none of the stiff, mechanistic movements of the animatronic animal. It did a small dance step, spun, and took a deep bow. Then it reached up and took off its own head, revealing the man inside the costume. "I guess I shouldn't be surprised," Carlton said, his nerves triggering an automatic wisecrack. "Never trust a rabbit, I say." It didn't make sense. It wasn't funny, but the words were coming out of his mouth without any input from his brain. He still felt sick. His head still ached, but he had a sudden, visceral clarity. This is what happened to Michael. You are what happened to Michael.
"Don't speak," Dave said.
Carlton opened his mouth to answer back, but the smart remark died on his tongue when he saw the guard's face. He had seemed somehow faded when they met, depleted and ineffectual. But now, as he stood over Carlton in his absurd-looking rabbit costume, he looked different. His face was the same, technically, his gaunt features and sunken eyes, his skin that seemed to have worn thin, ready to snap from strain. But now there was a mean, undeniable strength in him, a rodentine vitality that Carlton recognized. It had occurred to Carlton years before that there were two types of nasty people. There were the obvious ones, like his sixth-grade English teacher who yelled and threw erasers, or the kid in fifth grade who picked fights with smaller children after school. That type was easy. Their offenses public, brutal, and undeniable. But then there was the other kind of petty tyrant, those who grew spiteful with their small scraps of power, feeling more and more abused by the year, by family who did not appreciate them, by neighbors who slighted them in imperceptible ways, by a world that left them, somehow, lacking something essential. Before him stood someone who had spent so much of his life fighting like a cornered rat that he had taken on the mantle of bitter sadism as an integral part of himself. He would strike out against others and revel in their pain, feeling righteously that the world owed him his cruel pleasures. The guard's face, with its malevolent delight in Carlton's pain and fear, was one of the most terrifying things he had ever seen. He opened and closed his mouth, then, valiantly, found his voice.
"What kind of a name for a serial killer is Dave?" he said.
It came out as a trembling croak, lacking even the echo of bravado. Dave did not seem to hear him.
"I told you not to move, Carlton," he said calmly.
He set the rabbit's head down on a plastic crate and began fiddling with the fastenings at the back of his neck.
"It's not an order. It's a friendly warning. Do you know what I've put you in?"
"Your girlfriend?" Carlton said, and Dave made a thin curve of a smile.
"You're amusing," he said with distaste. "But no, you're not wearing a costume, Carlton. Not precisely. You see, these suits were designed for two purposes. To be worn by men like me."
He gestured fluidly toward himself, with something that might have been pride.
"And to be used as working animatronics like the ones you see on the stage. Do you understand?"
Carlton nodded, or began to, but Dave's raised eyebrow stopped him.
"I said don't move," he said.
The neck of his costume came open, and he began to undo a second fastening at his back as he talked.
"You see, all of the animatronic parts in that suit are still in it. They are simply held back by spring locks, like this."
Dave went to the pile of costumes and selected one, bringing the fuzzy green torso, headless, over to Carlton. He held out the costume, waggling two twisted pieces of metal that were attached to the sides of the neck.
"These are spring locks," he said, bringing the piece of metal so close to Carlton's face he almost could not focus his eyes on it. "Watch."
He did something, touched some piece of the lock so imperceptibly that Carlton could not see what he had done, and it snapped shut with a sound like a backfiring car. Carlton stiffened, suddenly taking the order not to move deathly seriously.
"That's a very old costume, one of the first ones Henry made. You can trip these spring locks very, very easily if you don't know what you're doing. Dave went on. It takes almost no movement at all.
Henry? Carlton said, trying to focus on what he was being told. He could still hear the snap, as if it had lodged in his head like a song that kept repeating. I'm going to die, he thought for the first time since waking. This man will kill me. I will die. And then what? Will anyone even know? He set his jaw and met Dave's eyes. Who's Henry?
Henry, Dave repeated. Your friend Charlie's father.
He looked surprised.
Did you not know that he made this place?
Oh, right, well, Carlton said confusedly. I just always thought of him as Charlie's dad.
Of course,
Dave said, the kind of polite murmur people made when they didn't care.
Well, that's one of his first suits, he said, gesturing at Carlton. And if you trigger those spring locks, two things will happen. First, all the locks will snap right into you, making deep cuts all over your body, and a split second later, all the animatronic parts they've been holding back, all that sharp steel and hard plastic, will instantly be driven into your body. You will die, but it will be slow. You'll feel your organs punctured, the suit will grow wet with your blood, and you will know you're dying for long, long minutes. You'll try to scream, but you will be unable to. Your vocal cords will be severed, and your lungs will fill with your own blood until you drown in it.
There was a faraway look in his eyes, and Carlton knew with chilling certainty that Dave wasn't predicting. He was reminiscing.
How?
Carlton's voice broke, and he tried again.
How do you know that?
He said, managing a raspy whisper. Dave met his eyes and smiled widely.
How do you think?
He set down the costume he was holding and reached up to undo the final piece of his own. It took time. Carlton watched for several minutes as Dave romanced whatever mechanisms lay under the collar. He took the costume torso off with a flourish, and Carlton made an involuntary sound, a helpless and frightened mule. Dave had been shirtless under the costume, and now his bare chest was clearly visible even in the dim, flickering light. His skin was horribly scarred, with raised white lines that scored his flesh in a symmetrical pattern, each side of his body mirroring the other. Dave saw him looking and laughed a sudden, happy sound. Carlton shivered at it. Dave raised his arms out from his body and turned slowly in a circle, giving Carlton ample time to see that the scars were everywhere, covering his back like a faint lace shirt, stretching to the waist of the rabbit pants as if they continued all the way down. On the back of his neck, where they were largest and most visible, two scars like parallel lines were etched from the nape of his neck all the way up to his scalp, disappearing into his hair. Carlton tried to swallow. His mouth was so dry he could not have spoken, even if there had been anything to say. Dave smiled unpleasantly.
Don't move, he said again.
He's here! He has to be here! Marla cried, staring despairingly at the door to Freddy's.
She was clasping and unclasping her hands, the knuckles going white. Charlie watched her helplessly. There was nothing to say. The door was no longer covered in chains. Instead, it was simply no longer a door. It had been welded over. The metal was melted seamlessly into the frame, and the hinges were gone, covered in crude, patchy solder. They all stared, not fully able to comprehend what they were looking at. Charlie shifted her feet. She had stepped in a puddle as they hurried from the car, and now her shoes and socks were soaked and freezing. It seemed unforgivable to be focused on her own discomfort in such a moment, but she could not stop her attention from drifting to it.
This is insane, Marla said, her mouth agape.
Who does this?
She threw up her hands in frustration.
Who does something like that?
She was almost shouting.
Someone did that. Someone welded this shut. What if Jason is in there?
Marla put her hands over her face. Jessica and Lamar stepped forward to comfort her, but she waved them away.
I'm fine,
she said tightly, but she did not move, still staring at the place in the wall that had once been a door. She looked smaller, lesser. The panicked energy that had been driving her was gone, leaving her empty and without purpose. She looked at Charlie, ignoring the others, and Charlie met her eyes uncomfortably.
What do we do?
Marla asked. Charlie shook her head.
I don't know, Marla, she said uselessly. If he's in there, we have to get him out. There has to be a way.
There has to be another way in, John agreed, though he sounded surer than Charlie felt. Freddy's had windows, a service door, right? There must have been fire exits. There has to be something.
Stop!
Marla cried, and they all froze in place. She was pointing at the floor.
What is it?
Charlie asked, coming up next to her.
It's Jason's footprint, Marla said. Look, you can see the imprint. It's those silly shoes he spent a year's allowance on.
Charlie looked. Marla was right. There was a muddy footprint about Jason's size, still fresh. Marla's face was alive again, fiery and determined.
He must have just been here, Marla said. Look, you can see the tracks turn and leave again. The door must have already been welded when he got here. He's probably still here somewhere. Come on!
Jason's tracks were heading farther down the alley, into the darkness, and the group crouched low to the ground, following his trail. Charlie hung back, not really helping but keeping an eye on the bobbing flashlight ahead. There was something she was forgetting, something she should know, something about Freddy's. Noticing that she was apart, John let the others move ahead.
You okay?
He asked in a low voice, and Charlie shook her head.
I'm fine, she said. Go ahead.
He waited for her to say more, but she was staring ahead into the dark.
Another way in.
Found it!
Jessica's voice pierced the dark, and Charlie came back to herself and jogged to catch up to the others. Lamar had the flashlight again, and he was aiming it at an air vent close to the ground. The vent was old and rusty, and its covering lay flat on the ground amid scattered footprints and clumps of mud.
Jason, what are you doing?
Marla gasped and knelt beside the vent.
What are you thinking?
There was an edge to her voice, something teetering between panic and relief.
We have to go after him, she said.
Charlie watched, dubious, but said nothing. It was John who spoke up.
It's too small, he said. I don't think any of us will fit.
Marla looked down at herself, then around at the others one by one, calculating.
Jessica, she said decisively. Come on. What?
Jessica looked to the side as if there might be another of her.
I don't think I'll fit, Marla. You're the skinniest, Marla said shortly. Just try, okay?
Jessica nodded and went to the vent, kneeling in the muddy concrete that was the alley's floor. She studied the hole in the wall for a moment and tried to squeeze in, but her shoulders barely cleared the space, and after a moment she pulled back out, out of breath.
Marla, I can't fit. I'm sorry, she said. You can fit, Marla said. Please, Jessica.
Jessica looked back at the others, and when Charlie saw her face, it was almost white, harshly expressionless.
She's claustrophobic, Charlie thought.
But before she could speak, Jessica was back at the air vent, twisting herself, trying again to fit.
Please,
Marla said again, and Jessica shot back out like something had bitten her.
I can't, Marla,
she said, her breathing shallow and fast, as if she had been running full out.
I don't fit. There has to be another way in.
Charlie stepped in, reaching her arm between Marla and Jessica as though breaking up a fight. Charlie closed her eyes, trying again to remember. She pictured the restaurant, trying to see it not as they had the last few days, but as it had been years before. The lights were bright. It was full of people. "It used to get hot, stuffy," she said. "In summer, it smelled like pizza and old French fry grease and sweaty kids, and my dad would say, 'That's it.' He would say, 'Whose brilliant idea was it to put a skylight in a closet?'" She finished triumphantly, relieved. She could picture the little supply room with the open roof. She and Sammy would sneak away and sit in there for a few minutes, enjoying the small stream of fresh air that filtered down from outside.
"So that's it. Let's get to the roof," John said, breaking Charlie's drift into memory.
"What roof?" Marla said, studying the top of the closed hall. She was no longer in a full-blown panic, reassured by evidence that Jason was still alive, but her anxiety was still palpable. Her glance darted constantly around the little group, as if her little brother might suddenly appear from the shadows.
"It's been covered over, like everything else," Lamar chimed in.
"Maybe not," Charlie said. "The roof of the mall is pretty high. I bet there's a crawl space at least."
"A crawl space?" John said excitedly. "You mean a crawl space between the roof of Freddy's and the roof of the mall? Up there?"
He stared up into the darkness for a moment.
"A crawl space,"
he repeated, his voice a little meeker. Charlie was busy studying the ceiling of the corridor, measuring it in her head against what they had seen of the outside of the building. It was different, she was sure of it. "This isn't the roof to the mall. It's not high enough," she said, feeling a spark of encouragement. She set off briskly down the hall, not waiting for the others. They followed, trailing behind her, and the space above her suddenly became illuminated as Lamar caught up and cast the beam of the flashlight upward. Charlie was going back and forth, looking from wall to ceiling and back again, while trying to picture the space outside.
"The ceiling of this hall is probably level with the roof of Freddy's," Jessica's voice came from behind Charlie, who startled briefly. She had been so intent on her pursuit she had lost track of her friends.
"We have to get up there," Charlie said, turning back to the group expectantly. They looked blankly at her for a second. Then Lamar's arm moved reflexively, like he was about to raise his hand. He caught himself and cleared his throat instead.
"I hate to point out the obvious, but," Lamar said, gesturing.
About 10 feet ahead of them, a maintenance ladder rested against the old brick. Charlie grinned and hurried to the ladder, waving for John to follow. They grabbed it together. It was heavy, metal, and covered with spatters of paint, but it was manageable to carry. When Charlie had a firm grip on one side of the ladder, she turned her face back to the ceiling, searching.
"There is probably a hole or a hatch or something," she said.
"A hole or a hatch or something?" John echoed with a half-smile as he lifted the other end of the ladder.
"Do you have a better idea? Now come on."
She jerked the ladder forward so hard John stumbled and almost fell. They moved slowly. With only one flashlight, they could not see where they were going and examine the walls at the same time, so every few yards they stopped for Lamar to run the light back and forth across the place where the brick wall met the dripping ceiling of the makeshift hallway. Though it slowed them down, Charlie was grateful for the breaks. The ladder, industrial metal, was heavy. She could have asked the others to switch off, but it felt essential somehow that she be part of the physical process. She wanted to help. Marla's agitation was growing as they went, and after a few rounds of move and scan, she started calling Jason's name softly.
"Jason? Jason, can you hear me?"
"He's inside," John said shortly. "He can't hear you."
His voice was strained with the weight of the ladder. He had the wider end, and he sounded almost snappish. Marla glared at him.
"You don't know that," Marla, stop it, Jessica said. We're doing everything we can.
Marla didn't answer. A few minutes later, they came to the end of the alley.
So now what? John said.
I don't know, Charlie said, puzzled. I was positive that we would find something.
Is that the way life usually works for you?
John teased, raising an eyebrow at her. From down the hall, Lamar let out a triumphant cry.
Found it!
Marla took off toward him at a run, and Jessica followed a little more cautiously behind, wary of obstacles in the dark. Charlie gave John a wink and picked up the ladder again. He hurried to lift his side, and they lugged it back the way they came. When Charlie and John caught up to the rest of the group, all three were looking up at the ceiling. Charlie mimicked their posture. Sure enough, there was a square trapdoor, big enough for an adult to pass through, its edges barely visible in the darkness. Without speaking, they set up the ladder. It was perhaps 10 feet high and rose close enough to the ceiling to access the door easily. Marla climbed up first as Lamar steadied the ladder on one side, Jessica on the other. John and Charlie watched as Marla ascended.
So, the trapdoor there,
John pointed up at it.
The trapdoor of this hallway is right next to Freddy's. That will get us onto the roof of Freddy's, which is under the roof of the mall, in a crawl space. And on Freddy's roof, there's a skylight, which we will find while crawling through the crawl space.
He drew an invisible diagram in the air with his finger as he spoke, and his tone was edged with skepticism. Charlie did not respond. Marla's footsteps on the ladder sounded through the hall, heavy, tinny thuds that echoed unsteadily all around them.
Once we find the skylight in the crawl space, John went on, not certain if Charlie was even listening, we are going to drop down through the skylight and into Freddy's, possibly with no way of getting back out.
At the top of the ladder, Marla fiddled with something on the ceiling that the others could not see, making little mutters of frustration.
Is it locked?
Charlie called up.
Okay, sure,
John said, aware by now that he was talking only to himself.
This makes sense.
The bolt is just stuck, Marla said. I need... Ha!
A dull snapping sound rang out.
Got it!
She cried. She raised her hands over her head and pressed upward, and slowly the door opened above her until it tipped over and fell with a thud.
So much for sneaking in, John said dryly.
It doesn't matter, Charlie said. We still have to go. Besides, do you really think whoever is in there doesn't know we're coming?
Above them, Marla was navigating her way up through the door. She braced her arms on either side of the space and pushed up off the ladder. It swayed dangerously, and Lamar and Jessica clutched it, trying to stabilize it, but it was not necessary. Marla was already up and through, on the roof. They waited for her to say something.
Marla?
Jessica called finally.
Yeah, I'm fine, Marla said. What do you see?
Charlie called.
Throw me the light.
Marla's arm emerged from the trap door, flapping impatiently. Lamar got a bit closer and carefully lobbed the flashlight up. Marla snatched it out of the air, and immediately the beam vanished. The light had gone out. In the crawl space, Marla sat in the dark trying to fix the flashlight. She shook it, rattling the batteries, and flipped the switch on and off uselessly. As she unscrewed the top of the light and blew into the battery cage, she felt a rising panic. Since realizing Jason had gone, Marla's entire being had been focused on him. It was only now, alone in the darkness, that she began to think about the danger she herself might be in. She screwed the top back onto the flashlight, and it came on instantly. The light flashed in her eyes, briefly clouding her vision. She pointed it away, then carefully swept it in a circle around her, revealing a sprawling void in all directions. It was the roof of Freddy Fazbear's Pizza.
What do you see?
Charlie called again.
You were right, There's space, but not much. It's so dark, and it smells awful up here.
Her voice sounded shaky even to her own ears, and suddenly she was desperate not to be alone in this place.
Hurry! Don't leave me up here by myself! We're coming!
Jessica called up to her. Me next, Charlie said, stepping forward. The ladder was rusty, and it made squeaking complaints as she climbed, protesting her weight as she moved from step to step. But it felt sturdy, and quickly she reached the trap door and did as Marla had done. She stood on the top step so she was head and shoulders through the door, braced her arms on either side, and pushed off the ladder, almost jumping, to land on Freddy's roof. There was not room to stand, scarcely room to sit. The space between the restaurant's roof and the mall's roof above it was less than a yard. Something was rattling above them, as if stones were falling overhead, and it took Charlie a moment to realize that it was the rain thundering on the uninsulated tin. Water dripped in on her head, and when she looked up, she saw a place where the metal's seams had not been joined, two corrugated sheets simply lined up next to each other, allied by circumstance. She wiped her palms on her jeans. The shingles of the roof were wet, and her hands were covered in grit, dust, and something slick and more unpleasant. She looked toward Marla, who was a few feet away.
"Here, come on. Get out of their way," Marla said,
motioning her over, and Charlie hurried on her hands and knees. Jessica's head appeared in the trap door, and carefully she made her way up into the crawl space. Safely on the roof, Jessica looked around as if gauging something. Concerned, Charlie remembered her fear in the air vent, but Jessica took a long, deep breath.
"I can handle this," she said, though she did not sound as if she believed her own words.
A moment later, Lamar was next to them. He quickly reclaimed the flashlight and aimed it back toward the trap door. After a moment, John scrambled up into the crawl space, and something banged loudly beneath them, the sound repeating. Everyone but John startled at the sound.
"Sorry," he said. "That was the ladder."
"Charlie, which way?" Marla asked.
"Oh."
Charlie closed her eyes again, retraced her steps as she had while they'd searched for a way in.
"Straight across, I think," she said. "As long as we get to the far side, we'll find it."
Without waiting for responses, she started crawling in the direction she thought was right. A second later, light appeared ahead of her.
"Thanks,"
she called back softly to Lamar, who was steadying the flashlight, trying to anticipate where Charlie would go.
"I don't have anything else to do," he whispered.
The crawl space was wide. It should have felt spacious, but there were support beams and pipes strewn at random, intersecting the space or running across the roof below them, so that it was a little like navigating a very cramped forest, ducking vines and climbing over fallen trees. The roof of Freddy's had a shallow upward slope. They would have to go down again once they reached the middle. The shingles beneath their hands and feet were soggy in a deep, swollen way that suggested they had not been truly dry in years, and a moldy smell rose from them. Every once in a while, Charlie wiped her hands on her pants, knowing they would only be clean for a moment. From time to time, she thought she heard something skitter by, sounds a little too far away to be coming from their group, but she ignored them. "They have more right to be here than we do," she thought, though she was not certain what species they might be. The roof above them followed a bizarre pattern, sloping up and down without regard to the roof beneath, so that at one point it opened 4 feet above their heads, then at another plunged downward so close that it grazed their backs, forcing them to duck their heads and wriggle awkwardly through. Jessica was right behind Charlie, and from time to time she could hear her friend make soft, frightened noises, but every time she looked back, Jessica just nodded, stone-faced. They continued until they reached the wall that marked the edge of the roof.
"Okay,"
Charlie called, half turning behind her.
It should be near here. Let's spread out and look. No, wait. What's that?
Marla said, pointing. Charlie could not see what Marla had spotted, but she followed the direction until she came to it. The skylight was a flat glass pane in the roof, framed like a small window, a single panel with no visible handles, hinges, or latches. They leaned over it, trying to see into the room below, but the glass was too covered in grime for anything to show through. John reached forward and tried to clean it with his sleeve. He came away with the arm of his shirt black, but it had done no good. At least half the dirt was on the other side, and the skylight was still opaque with filth.
It's just a closet. It's okay, Charlie said.
But is anyone in the closet? Lamar said.
It doesn't matter, said Marla. We don't have a choice.
Everyone looked at Charlie, who thoughtfully studied the skylight.
It swings in, she said. You pull down on this side, she pointed, and it swings. There's a latch on the inside, right there.
She touched the side of the skylight, thinking.
Maybe if we...
She pushed on it, and it gave way almost instantly, jolting her with a sudden, panicked sense of falling, even though her weight was solidly on the roof.
That's kind of narrow, John said.
The skylight did not open all the way. The glass just tilted inward a little, barely enough for a person to slip through.
I didn't build it, Charlie said, slightly irritated. This is it. So if you're going, go.
Without waiting for a response, she swung her legs over the sill and lowered herself down, dangling for a moment in the dark. Closing her eyes and hoping the floor was not as far away as she remembered, she let go and fell. She landed. The shock of impact ran through her legs, but it passed quickly.
Bend your knees when you land,
she called up as she got out of the way. Marla dropped through, and Charlie went to the door, trying to find a light switch. Her fingers stumbled across the switch, and she flipped it up. The old fluorescent lights clicked and buzzed, and then slowly a dim and unreliable glow filled the space.
All right, she whispered with a thrill of excitement.
She turned around, and as something brushed her face, she had a fleeting impression of big plastic eyes and broken yellow teeth. She screamed and leaped back, clutching for balance at shelves that swayed as she grabbed them. The head she had touched, an uncovered wire frame for a costume with nothing but eyes and teeth to decorate it, wobbled precariously on the shelf beside Charlie, then fell to the ground. Her heart still pounding, Charlie brushed at herself roughly as if she were covered in spider webs, her legs unsteady as she moved back and forth with agitation. The head rolled across the floor, then came to rest at her feet, looking up at her with its cheerful, sinister smile. Charlie jerked back from the ghastly grin, and something grabbed her from behind. She tried to yank free, but she was stuck, a pair of metal arms wrapped around her. The bodiless limbs clung to her shirt, their hinges biting into the cloth, and as she tried to wrest herself away, her hair was caught, too, tangling her deeper into the wire until she felt like she would be consumed. Charlie screamed again, and the arms reached out farther, seeming to grow as she struggled against them. She fought back with all her strength, fueled by terror and a base, frantic fury that this thing would hurt her.
Charlie, stop! Marla cried. Charlie!
Marla grabbed her arm, trying to stop her frantic movement, using one hand to disengage Charlie's hair from the metal frame.
Charlie, it's not real. It's just robot parts, she said.
But Charlie pulled away from Marla, still in a panic, and smacked her head into a cardboard box. She cried out, startled, as the box overturned. Eyes the size of fists fell to the ground like rain, showering down with a clatter and rolling everywhere, covering the floor. Charlie stumbled and stepped on one of the hard plastic orbs, sending her feet out from under her. She grabbed at a shelf, missed, and fell on her back, landing with a thud that took the wind out of her. Stunned and gasping, she looked up. There were eyes everywhere, not just on the floor, but in the walls. They looked out at her from the dark, deep-socketed, shadowed eyes peering down from the shelves all around her. She stared, unable to look away. "Charlie, come on." Marla was there, kneeling anxiously over her. She grabbed Charlie's arm again and pulled until Charlie was upright. Charlie still did not have her breath back, and as she inhaled thinly, she began to cry. Marla hugged her tightly, and Charlie let her.
"It's okay, it's okay,"
Marla whispered as Charlie tried to calm herself, looking around the storeroom for distraction.
"It's not real," she told herself. They were in a storeroom, just a closet, and these were all spare parts.
The air was thick with dust, and it tickled at her nose and throat as it poured off the shelves restlessly. The rest of the group dropped through the skylight one by one. John came last, landing in the middle of the room with a thump. Jessica sneezed.
"You okay?"
John said as soon as he saw Charlie.
"Yeah, I'm fine."
Charlie disentangled herself from Marla and crossed her arms, still collecting herself.
"You know we can't get back up through there," John said, looking up at the skylight.
"We just need something to stand on," Charlie said. "Or we can climb a shelf."
Jessica shook her head.
"No, look at the way it's opened."
Charlie looked. The skylight opened downward, so the pane of glass sloped in at a gentle angle, just enough to have let them through. To get out, they would have to... "Oh," she said. There would be no getting out. However close they got to the skylight, the pane of glass would always be in the way, sticking out into the precise space they needed to pass through. If anyone tried to get a grip on the roof, they would have to lean so far over the glass that they would fall from the ladder.
"We might be able to break the glass," John started. "But the metal frame is going to be dangerous to climb over, even more dangerous with shards of broken glass."
He fell silent and thought it through again, his face grim.
"It doesn't matter," Charlie said. "We'll find another way out. Let's start looking."
They peered cautiously out into the hallway. Lamar had turned off the flashlight, but it was easy enough to see their surroundings now with the light from the closet seeping into the hall.
"At least nothing's dripping from the ceiling," Charlie thought, wiping her hands on her pants again.
The floor was black and white tile, as glossy as if it had just been polished. There were children's drawings on the walls, rustling with the air from the open skylight. Charlie remained motionless, more than aware of how much noise she had just made.
"Does it know we're here?"
she wondered, realizing as she did that by "it," she meant the building itself. It felt as if Freddy's was conscious of their presence, as if it reacted to them like a living, breathing thing. She reached out to brush her fingers against its wall, tracing lightly as if she were petting it. The plaster was still and cold, inanimate, and Charlie pulled her hand back. She wondered what Freddy's would do. They wound around one corner, then another, and then stopped at the entrance to Pirate's Cove, hanging back from the doorway.
"Pirate's Cove, I have my bearings again."
Charlie gazed at the little stage, no longer lit, and the curtain that hid its sole performer. A few small lights flickered on the sides of the stage, then came on, illuminating the space with a pale gray glow. Charlie looked around and saw Lamar standing by the doorway with his hand on a switch.
"We don't have a choice," he said defensively, gesturing to his flashlight.
Its light was failing. Charlie nodded resignedly, and Lamar switched off the dying flashlight.
"I want to take a look in this control room," Marla said, pointing to the small door nearby. "Lamar, come with me. The rest of you try the other one. If we each take one set of cameras, we can see the whole restaurant. If Jason's in this place, we'll see him."
"I don't think we should split up,"
Charlie said.
Wait, said Lamar.
He passed John the dead light, freeing his hands. From his pockets he produced two walkie-talkies. They were large, black, boxy things Charlie had only seen attached to police officers' belts.
Where did you get those? She asked.
Lamar smiled mysteriously.
I'm afraid I can't tell you that, he said.
He stole them from Carlton's house, Jessica stated plainly, taking one from his hand and examining it.
No, they were in the garage. Mrs. Burke told me where to find them. They work, I tested.
Mrs. Burke knew we would come here? Charlie thought. Marla just nodded. Maybe she had already known, or maybe nothing could surprise her anymore.
Come on, Marla said and walked between the tables in front of Pirate's Cove, careful not to disturb anything.
Lamar leaned over Jessica to show her how to use the walkie-talkie.
It's this button, he said, indicating it,
and then he took off after Marla. After a startled moment, the rest of them followed. Something clutched in Charlie's stomach. The reality that both Jason and Carlton might truly be in danger seizing her. It was not that she had forgotten, but while they were outside, trying to solve the puzzles, it was possible to gain some distance from what was happening. She watched Marla stalking toward the control room with a bleak authority. Marla crouched at the small door before turning to Charlie.
Go,
she said, nodding toward the hall that led to the main dining area. They went, Charlie taking the lead as they crept down the hall, heading for the main stage. Marla looked at Lamar, who nodded. She grasped the doorknob, clenched her teeth, and forced the door open all in one motion.
Marla!
Marla jumped, barely suppressing a scream. Jason was huddled in the space beneath the monitors, his eyes wide and terrified, staring at the door like a frightened mouse.
Jason!
Marla crawled into the control room and swooped him into her arms. Jason hugged her back, for once grateful, even desperate, for her intense affection. She held on tight, crushing him to her until he began to worry that he might, in fact, be crushed. From outside Marla's consuming embrace, Jason heard brief static. He looked over Marla's shoulder to see Lamar studying the walkie-talkie, preparing to speak into it.
Jessica, we found him. He's okay, he said.
More static and words Jason did not quite catch came from the radio. The first wave of relief had worn off, and his ribs were starting to hurt.
Marla?
He tapped her on the shoulder, first gently, then harder.
Marla!
She let him go but took hold of his shoulders for a moment, peering into his eyes as if to be sure it was really him, that he had not been somehow replaced or irrevocably damaged.
Marla, cool it,
he said as casually as he could, managing to keep his voice from shaking. Marla let go of his shoulders, giving him a playful shove, and began to scold him as she pulled him the rest of the way out from under the control panel.
Jason, how could you—
Marla was interrupted as Lamar descended the rest of the way into the small room.
Through the vent? Really?
Lamar laughed.
You could have been killed, crawling through the air duct like that,
Marla added, grasping his shoulders. Jason fought free, flailing his arms until she let him go.
Okay, he exclaimed. Everybody missed me. Good. Glad to know I'm important.
You are important, Marla said fiercely, and Jason rolled his eyes theatrically. The little room lit up as Lamar flipped a switch, bringing the screens to life. Marla looked at Jason thoughtfully, then turned her attention to the security cameras.
Okay, let's see what we can see.
Lamar looked from screen to screen. The top middle screen showed the main dining room and the stage, and as they watched, Charlie, Jessica, and John appeared, crossing the room in a V formation, Charlie at the front.
Look,
Marla said suddenly, pointing to the screen at the lower right.
Look!
The night guard was there. Though they could not make out his face,
His baggy uniform and sagging shoulders told them that it was the same man. He was in the hall near the restaurant's entrance, walking past the party rooms in the arcade with a slow, purposeful gait.
"Lamar, warn them,"
Marla ordered urgently. Lamar spoke into the walkie-talkie.
"Jessica, the guard is somewhere around there. Hide."
There was no response from the radio, but on screen the group of three froze. Then, as one, they made for the control room under the stage, squeezing in and closing themselves in just as the guard appeared in the doorway.
Voices. People moving around.
Carlton did not allow himself to sigh in relief. A rescue wouldn't do him any good if he got his insides punctured by 100 tiny robot parts first. Instead, he continued with what he had been doing, inching his way across the floor and into the view of the security camera that perched near the ceiling just above the door. Each movement was so scarce it felt like nothing, but he had been doing this for over an hour, and he was almost, almost there. He kept his breathing steady, using his trapped hands to lift his body a tiny bit, move to the side, and let himself down again, just a little farther to the right. His fingers were cramping and his head still ached, but he kept going, relentless. Although he was still afraid, still painfully aware of how easily he could trigger his own death, at some point the fear had dulled, or perhaps he had just become accustomed to it. Panic could not last forever. Eventually, the adrenaline had run out. Now, at least, the need for slow, precise movement took precedence over everything else. It was all there was. Carlton made one final movement and stopped, closing his eyes for a moment. He had made it. Can't stop now. The others were here. It had to be them. And if they were looking for him, they would check the cameras. He stared up into the lens, willing himself to be seen. He could not wave or jump up and down. He tried rocking back and forth a little, but no matter how stiffly he held himself, he felt the press of spring locks ready to give. He bit his lip in frustration. "Just see me," he whispered to no one, but all at once he felt as if he had been heard, felt the inexplicable sense of someone else's presence in the room. His heart began to race again, the adrenaline that had given out finding its second wind. Carefully, slowly, he looked around, until something caught his eye. It was only one of the costumes, slumped empty in the shadows, half hidden in the corner of the room. It was motionless, but its face was pointed directly at him, staring. As Carlton looked back, he realized that deep within the recesses of the costume's eye sockets were two tiny glints of light. He felt little muscles twitch, a restrained shudder running through his body, not quite enough to get him killed. He did not look away. As Carlton held the creature's gaze, he felt himself begin to calm. His heart's pounding eased, and his breath grew even. It was as though suddenly he was safe, though he knew the suit he was wearing was still only one flinch, one startled jump from killing him. Carlton kept looking at those two pinpoints of light, and as he did, he heard a voice. In a gasping instant, all the air was sucked from his lungs. As the voice spoke, that voice he would have known anywhere— that voice he would have given anything to hear again. Carlton began to weep, using all his will to keep his body from shaking. The eyes in the dark were intent on his face as the voice went on, speaking secrets to Carlton in the ringing silence, telling him things that he dreaded, things that someone had to hear.
Chapter 10.
The screens all lost their pictures and flipped to static.
"Hey!"
Marla cried. She banged against the side of a monitor, and the image lurched, distorted, then sputtered and went out again. She hit it again, and with another spasm of static, the image slowly cleared. As it resolved, the stage appeared.
Something's wrong, Lamar said, and all three leaned forward, trying to get a better look.
Bonnie, Jason said in a grave tone. Bonnie, Marla echoed, looking at Lamar with alarm. Where's Bonnie?
Lamar hit the button on the walkie-talkie.
Charlie, he said urgently. Charlie, don't leave the control room.
In the control room under the stage, Charlie and Jessica peered at the monitors, scanning for signs of life.
It's too dark. I can't see anything on these, Jessica complained.
There, Charlie said, pointing. Jessica blinked.
I can't see anything, she insisted.
It's Carlton, right there. I'm going to get him. Not waiting for a response, Charlie crawled toward the exit.
Charlie, wait, John said, but she was already out the door.
It slammed shut behind her, and all three of them heard the dull metal thud of the drop lock falling into place.
Charlie!
John yelled again, but she was already gone.
It's bolted shut, John grunted as he pulled on the door.
The walkie-talkie sputtered, and Lamar's voice came choppily from the little box.
Charlie, don't leave room.
Jessica and John exchanged a glance, and John picked up the radio.
Too late,
he said, looking to Jessica as he lowered the walkie-talkie. Charlie made her way unsteadily between chairs, but after only moments she realized she had gotten herself turned around. The lighting had changed. Now a single blinding blue light was strobing on and off above the stage. Over and over, the room flashed with a blinding burst, like lightning, then was instantly dark again. Charlie covered her eyes, trying to remember what she had bumped into first. Metal chairs and foil party hats pulsed like beacons in the dark with each burst of light, and Charlie's head began to throb. She squinted, trying to orient herself, but beyond the tables surrounding her, all she could see were 1,000 after-images burned into her retinas. She had no idea which way to go to find Carlton. She leaned against a nearby chair and pressed her hand tightly over her forehead. A table screeched against the floor briefly, and Charlie knew that it hadn't been her. She turned around, but the light had gone dark. When it flashed again, she was looking directly at the stage, where there should have been 3 sets of eyes. She saw only 2. Freddie and Chica stared down at her, their plastic gazes catching the light, twinkling with the strobe. Their heads seemed to follow her as she moved along the table. Bonnie was gone. Suddenly she felt exposed, all at once noticing just how many places there were in the open room for something to hide, just how visible she was to anyone, anything, that might be watching. She thought briefly of the little control room she had just left and felt a pang of regret. Coming out here might have been very stupid. Another screech sounded, and she whirled around to see the table behind her moving slowly away. She turned to run, but she slammed into something before she could take a step. She jerked up her hands in the darkness to shield herself and touched matted fur. The strobe threw its light out again, and this time garbled noise blared from the gaping mouth in front of her. Bonnie. Bonnie stood only inches from her, his mouth opening and closing rapidly, and his eyes rolling wildly in his head. Charlie jerked away, then backed up slowly. The rabbit did not try to follow, just continued his bizarre and silent incantation, his eyes aimlessly ricocheting in his head. Her foot caught on the leg of a metal folding chair. She fell back, landing hard on her bottom. She started to crawl, staying low, hurrying to get away from Bonnie. A spotlight flashed from the stage, this one clearly aimed at her. She raised her hand to see who was there, but the light blinded her. All she could make out were 2 sets of following eyes. Charlie screamed and scrambled to her feet. She took off running, not looking back, and made it across the room into the hallway that led to Pirate's Cove. She ducked into the bathroom along its wall. The door echoed when it shut behind her. The room was empty, with nothing but 3 sinks and 3 stalls. Only one of the fluorescent lights was on,
and just barely, only enough to color the room dark.